stories, Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei received the first dose of a domestically made coronavirus vaccine. The UN once again calls for an end to Israeli settlement plans and demolition of Palestinian homes in the occupied territories. Also ahead, Russia says Britain and the US try to incite conflict in the Black Sea amid tensions following the presence of a British destroyer off the coast of the Crimean Peninsula. Our top story, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has received the first dose of a domestically produced COVID vaccine. Ayatollah Khamenei received the first shot of COV-Iran Barakat vaccine and thanked all those involved in producing it. The leader said there is nothing wrong with using a foreign vaccine along with the Iranian one. However, he said he preferred to use an Iranian-made shot. COV-Iran Barakat was unveiled in December of last year. Its mass production began 3 months later. Iran is also working on producing several other vaccines to inoculate its population against the pandemic. The country is among the first nations that started developing coronavirus vaccines. Well, we had one of our men watching this for us, and that's no one better than Yusuf Jalali, who is here with us at our studios. Yusuf, it's good to see you. Tell us what we know about the latest development regarding the Iranian vaccine, and of course, the development today regarding the Iranian leader receiving the first jab, Iranian one.
Well, of course, Arash, that's a major development, and the fact that the Iranian leader, the highest ranking official in the country, receives an Iranian-made vaccine. This has a lot of messages. On top of them is the fact that he tries to build trust in the Iranian local vaccines, and that's COV-Iran Barakat, one of the viable and most reliable vaccines in the country, which is now ahead in the race. It has hit the market, and we've heard from the developers, which of course the developers of the vaccine are affiliated to the headquarters for the execution of Imam Khomeini's order. So this institute has been responsible for developing the vaccine, and they said that the vaccine is at least 90% effective against the coronavirus. And this is a very great development for the Iranian people. And the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said that he, of course, by receiving the first shot using an Iranian-made vaccine, he has put emphasis on the fact that the mass inoculation program in the country needs to be conducted using an Iranian vaccine. Of course, he had no problem with using foreign-made vaccines like Sputnik V or Sinopharm, as right now is the case. Iran is now inoculating the elderly population. People with more than 70 years old are now receiving their second shots using Sinopharm, the Chinese-made vaccine, and Sputnik V, the Russian-made vaccine. But now the developers of COV-Iran say that have assured the Iranian people that by November, they're going to, of course, use their vaccine, their jabs, to inoculate the Iranian citizens. So COV-Iran is one of the eight vaccines that are produced based on different platforms. As you also know, there are different platforms for trying to trigger an immune response from the human body against the coronavirus pandemic. The COV-Iran vaccine uses the attenuated version of the coronavirus pandemic. That's the weakened or killed version of the coronavirus using some special chemicals. There are other platforms like viral vector or recombinant proteins, which other Iranian-made vaccines like COV-PARS, Razi COV-PARS, or PASTOR, which is a vaccine that's jointly built by an Iranian and Cuban biotech firms. These different vaccines are using different platforms to fight the coronavirus, all boiling down to the fact that they're trying to trigger an immune response, or in fact, we should say trick the immune system into reacting to the entering coronavirus into the body. So Iran said that Of course, the Coviran Barakat said that they will be able to produce 10 million doses of their vaccine by November. That's a very significant step. And all of these things are coming against the backdrop of the fact that the country has been under severe sanctions, which have also impacted their fight against the coronavirus pandemic. Let me tell you something. From the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic, Iran has not been able even to import very basic health items like gloves, like guns, or even masks. And now Iran has moved from such a country to a country that is now able to produce its own vaccines. And now the country is eyeing for the global market. Iran is now focusing on exporting those domestically built vaccines to other countries. So now what we're expecting is that by November, Coviran Barakat will be the major jab that is going to be inoculated and injected to the Iranian people. We have also, we have Covpars, Razi Covpars, which is working based on a recombinant protein, and it's injected to the body, and it's also used and administered to the body through inhalation, both injection and inhalation. That's another platform for a COVID vaccine. So Covpars is also inching closer to the market. And we've heard that Pasteur, which is built and made jointly by an Iranian and Cuban biotech firms, it's also inching closer. It's also attaining the necessary permits for emergency use. That's going to be in less than 1 month.
I don't know how you do it, Youssef, but you've been doing a great job, you know, gathering up that information. Really, there is a lot of learning there. And thank you very, very much for sharing that with us. And of course, next time I talk to you, I hope that a greater part of the Iranian population has gotten vaccinated using the Iranian vaccine or otherwise. Thank you again, Youssef. It was good seeing you. Take care. Iran has rejected as highly politicized a Canadian forensic team report that accused Tehran of incompetence over a Ukrainian plane crash last year. Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister for International and Legal Affairs said Canada lacks authority to conduct a unilateral report on an air crash outside its jurisdiction. Mohsen Baharvand also rejected as technically unfounded the report's criticism of Iran's investigation into the incident. He said Iran has fulfilled its commitments under international law. The country mistakenly shut down the Ukrainian airliner in January of last year. 176 people were killed. Tehran has repeatedly said the incident was the result of human error in a high alert situation. It happened amid tensions with the U.S. over its assassination of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and Iran's retaliation for his killing. The UN says Israel is flagrantly violating international law by expanding settlements in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds. The UN called for an immediate cease to the advancement of all settlement activity. The call was made at a session on the implementation of a 2016 Security Council resolution that declared settlements have no legal validity. During the meeting, UN officials warned that Israeli settlements are a major obstacle to a solution to the decades-long conflict in the occupied territories. The UN called on Israel to end the demolition of Palestinian homes and other property, as well as the displacement of Palestinians. On Thursday, Israel advanced plans for 31 new settlement construction projects in the occupied West Bank. International human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan says UN measures to stop Israel's settlement expansion activity are just limited to resolutions. He says the world body should focus on taking concrete action.
Well, it's cruel, and in fact, in some cases, the Israelis force the Palestinians to demolish their own homes, which I think is really sick, quite frankly. You have the United Nations has, it's over 60 or 70 resolutions that have been condemning Israel, and Israel just ignores them because there's no substance to them and no concrete action taken. In most cases, when it's before the Security Council, the United States will veto the Security Council resolution. if I recall correctly, Obama did not veto one of the resolutions, and that sort of shook the Israelis a bit, but the Israelis just march on. It's creeping annexation and creeping ethnic cleansing as they each week they demolish more Palestinian homes, they annex more territory, and they use their policies to basically drive out the non-Jewish and the Palestinian population from the area.
The Yemeni army says it has launched a new drone attack against Saudi Arabia. The army says the latest attack hit King Khalid Air Base in the southwest of Saudi Arabia. It said the strike was conducted precisely and was in response to Saudi-led aggression against Yemen. On Thursday, Yemen also used 10 drones to hit a command post and training site near the Saudi border. Some 60 people were killed or injured. Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies backed by Washington launched a war on Yemen in March of 2015. Tens of thousands of Yemenis have been killed, many of them women and children. Russia has accused Britain and the United States of trying to incite conflict in the Black Sea amid rising tensions in the region. Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov said Washington and London are sowing strife, refusing to accept that Crimea is part of Russia. He said Moscow will defend its borders by all means, including with its military. Tensions run high following the presence of a British destroyer off the coast of the Crimean Peninsula on Wednesday. Russia said its forces fired warning shots and dropped bombs to deter the vessel, accusing it of entering Russian territorial waters. The UK, however, said the ship was conducting what is called innocent passage through Ukrainian territorial waters. It said the mission was in accordance with international law. German Chancellor Angela Merkel says EU leaders have rejected an immediate meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin.
It was not possible to agree today that we should meet immediately at the top level, but for me it is important that the dialogue format is maintained and that we work on it.
Merkel was speaking with reporters after the first day of talks by EU leaders. She said the talks on how to communicate more closely with Russia were detailed and not easy. Germany and France had proposed a summit with Moscow for what Paris called defending EU interests. However, it was turned down. Poland and Baltic countries said the proposal would send the wrong message as East-West ties deteriorate. Those relations have worsened over a number of issues, including the conflict in Ukraine. On to other stories now, Sudan has asked the UN Security Council to meet and discuss a dispute over a giant dam being built by Ethiopia on the Blue Nile. Ethiopia is pinning its hopes of economic development and power generation on this project. Mohammed Ali Fazari is in Khartoum.
Sudan's Foreign Minister Mariam Sadiq al-Mahdi called on the Security Council to hold a session as soon as possible to discuss Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam and its impacts on the safety and security of millions of people. In a letter to the council's head, al-Mahdi asked him to urge Ethiopia to stop the unilateral filling of the dam. He said which exacerbates the disputes and poses a threat to regional and international peace and security.
And they built.
Earlier, Sudan's Minister of Irrigation and Water Resources, Yasser Abbas, warned that if second filling is completed without a binding legal agreement, Sudan's legal teams backed by international legal firms would file a lawsuit against the Italian company that is executing the projects and demand compensation from the Ethiopian government.
I think it is a good way forward if the three countries believe that this is there should be a win-win situation, because the Ethiopians now, they brought into account the problem of how the quantities of water are going to be distributed between the two countries. We believe that this is not the right time. Now let us talk about the dam.
According to experts, Sudan wants Ethiopia to commit to legally binding agreements rather than guidelines on the amount of water retained and timetable for filling the reservoir. It also wants clarity on how disputes will be resolved in the future. Sudan, Egypt, and Ethiopia have been locked in an inclusive talks for nearly a decade over filling operation of the massive dam, which broke ground in 2011. The Ethiopian government says that projects known as GERD is crucial for economic development and power generation, but Egypt fears it will imperil its water supply. Sudan is also concerned about the effect on its own water flows.
Tension between Sudan and Ethiopia escalated since Addis Ababa rejected international mediation. That's why Sudan selected UN Security Council to raise the issue of GERD. Mohammed Ali Fazari, Khartoum.
The UK government is under pressure from the travel industry and the public to add more countries to the list of destinations which do not require people to quarantine for coronavirus upon return. Saeed Pourreza reports from London.
Britain's travel industry is frustrated and nervous. Protesting around the country on June 23rd, people whose jobs rely on international travel, now only working at 10% capacity. They want more countries on the so-called green list to save jobs.
It just doesn't make a lot of sense. And then why put some on the green list and then take them off? Like, say we booked a holiday to Portugal. We were supposed to be there this week and we've cancelled it because it went amber and it was going to cost another £1,000 in COVID tests.
The restrictions are now crazy. So I'm stuck in the London, not in the London, in England for quite a long time. And I wish to travel back to my country as I haven't seen my mom for 2 years.
Green means arrivals to the UK do not need to self-isolate, but have to take a test before and after they travel. Amber means self-isolating at home for up to 10 days, and red means quarantining at a hotel paid for by the travelers.
In the past few days, some government officials suggested double-jabbed passengers from amber-list countries could be exempt from quarantining.
We're also looking to see how we can replace the protections that are currently there with the restrictions, with protections that come from the vaccine, with respect to international travel as well. But it is more difficult freeing up international travel.
And difficult it will be when it comes to the willingness of other countries to let British tourists in. Germany has called on all EU countries to make British travelers quarantine on arrival to slow the spread of the Delta variant. All this as the UK recorded more than 16,000 new COVID cases Wednesday, the highest figure since early February, most of them caused by the Delta variant first discovered in India. There were also 19 deaths. The travel industry is yet to react to the government announcement, but with countries moving up and down the UK government's list, British travelers have to think again before they take a gamble. Saeed Pourreza, London.
And that's it with international news.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
Iran Today.
There's a new face to Iran. Well, it was anticipated, and it has been on TV quite a lot since 2019. but not as president. Sayed Ebrahim Raisi was announced president of the Islamic Republic a day after Friday elections on Saturday, June the 19th, 2021. Participation was under 50%, but over 61% of ballots were cast in Ayatollah Raisi's name. Looking at figures for the contestants trailing him, the win was by a landslide margin with over 17.9 million votes for the 61-year-old chief of the judiciary. Trailing him are Expediency Discernment Council Secretary Mohsen Rezai at 12% with over 3.4 million votes, former Central Bank of Iran Governor Abdel Nasser Hemmati at 8.5% or over 2.4 million votes, and Member of Parliament Amir Hossein Ghazi Zadeh Hashemi at 3.5%. with under a million votes. That's from a total of over 28.9 million votes, including voided blank or wrong votes of over 3.7 million, or 12.8% of the total ballots cast. But I'm not here just to repeat facts and figures, but to analyze the results and study what Mr. Raisi might do with his win, bearing in mind his performance as top judge so far and what the nation is expecting of him. I'm Leila Faramayazi. Stay with me for this study on Iran Today. Before checking out the practicality of Raisi's presidential mottos, let's just see why voter turnout has been at its lowest since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. That's 48.8%, including invalid votes that I might add were more than the votes won by the second in line, Mohsen Rezai. For that, I give you Mr. Izadi, Professor of International Studies, specializing in Iran-America relations.
Iran historically has had more people coming up. Iran has been an outlier in that sense, that more people show up to the polls. And this time, it was less than Iran's normal rates. And the reason are two. One is COVID. Polling places are crowded. Some people are concerned about going to crowded places. And the second reason is because Rouhani, the people who voted for Mr. Rouhani, some of them did not come to the polls.
All factors, causes and effects aside, the COVID-19 outbreak would have an unavoidable, uncontested effect on electoral participation anywhere, and by the most reliable findings. Based on data available from Harvard Dataverse, the French municipal elections were studied by Abdel Nouri. These elections took place at the very beginning of the ongoing pandemic and were held in over 9,000 municipalities on March the 15th, 2020. Turnout rates decreased to a historically low level, especially in places where the risk of infection was higher and with people more vulnerable to infection. And so, a robust relationship was established between the depressed turnout rate and the disease. Actually, there is another way of looking at the turnout. For this, I had a chat with Mr. Mohammad Reza Shojaian of Jame Jam Daily for a media man's take on the matter.
There has been a gray spectrum. People who said they were not going to vote, but at the last moment went to the ballot. What I'm saying is that it could be regarded as a component of democracy in the country, because we have a wide range of different thoughts and ideologies in the country. Since our nation isn't ruled by a totalitarian system, as some falsely advertise against the Islamic Republic of Iran, people have the right to vote. We have been given this right. No one went to the ballots at knife point. We must pay attention to that.
The question is, basically, how did Raisi get to win? The question arising I put to Mr. Naghavi, a former MP whom we always interviewed as an articulate political analyst. He received us at his electoral station from where he'd been campaigning to encourage voter participation.
Mr. Raisi was distinct among the seven presidential candidates. One can say that he had a clear advantage over the group. That's because the two reformist candidates, Mr. Mehrali Zadeh and Hemmati, weren't even endorsed by the reformists. This caused them not to have any motivation to engage in the competition or go to the polls. Or, for example, Mr. Himmati was considered a low-tier candidate of the executives of Construction Party. Among the principalists, also Mr. Ghazizadeh Zakani and Jalili were closer to a possible presidency. But Mr. Raisi was head and shoulders above them in terms of his experience and background.
Predictions were kinda spot on, and polls were mostly not far off from actual results, although not all polls predicted a turnout of under half the electorate. The electorate having been almost 59.5 million people eligible to vote, almost 1.4 million of whom were allowed to vote for the first time. In addition, around 3.5 million Iranian expatriates were also eligible to vote in 133 diplomatic Iranian missions in foreign lands.
The simple fact is that we didn't have the excitement we witnessed in the elections of 2017, 2013, 2005, or 1997. The excitement in those elections was tremendous. The turnout was over 70-80%. But this was a good election in its own right. About 48% of the eligible voters participated, which isn't unacceptable compared to other democratic systems. Although the elections are always filled with excitement and have 70-80% turnouts, 48% isn't too satisfactory for our people. But it's a good figure compared to other democratic systems.
A certain level of reduction in the turnout might actually not be a bad thing. Maybe that could serve as a wake-up call and a positive signal to our statesmen. We need to admit that over the past decade, we missed several opportunities, which created a level of mistrust among the people. Maybe what happened in this election could serve as a turning point for our statesmen to come to their senses and increase the turnout in the next races.
As for what Raisi is going to do with his win when he actually takes hold of the reins in about a month and a half, he is likely to have a major effect on Iran, although major foreign policy decisions will require a green light by the president's superior. That's leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Seyed Ali Khamenei. Generally, decisions on that scale are made by consensus by the Supreme National Security Council, which does feature a strong presence also by the president and leader. In his first press conference, President-elect Ebrahim Raisi highlighted his high-priority executive policies for the country in responding to questions by local and foreign journalists. The highlights were as such.
The basic commodities are a priority for the new government. Monitoring the supply chain from production until consumption will definitely be the government's priority. However, the bottom line is that we need to put an end to the relationship between people's livelihoods and the basic commodities and the dollar, or the issues happening outside the country in mid and long term, so that our nation would become self-sufficient in supplying the basic commodities. The message of the Iranian nation was the necessity of a change in the economic situation. In the meantime, I emphatically urge the United States to return to the JCPOA and comply with this commitment. The Iranian people expect you to abide by your obligations. This is our plan, and we will kick it off from the very beginning to promote the nation's self-sufficiency in producing the basic commodities, God willing. This vast and meaningful presence of the people occurred in spite of the coronavirus situation and hostilities and the psychological warfare of Iran's enemies. Anyone whose heart beats for the people and the revolution will be our partner everywhere in the country.
I asked what challenges Raisi would have to prioritize.
JCPOA would be something important, but during debates he emphasized the fact that Iran needs to work more with its neighbors. One way of going around sanctions is you do more in the neighborhood, so you don't have to worry about sanctions as much. And working with countries that like to work with Iran. Not all countries are Western in the world. And non-Western countries generally like to work with Iran. So increasing relations with non-Western countries is going to be another of his priorities.
popped out to see what people on the street thought of the president-elect.
Mr. Raisi spoke with people with honesty and didn't make empty promises like the other politicians.
We hope he can at least help us get out of the current situation a bit.
People were disappointed in the previous government and in fact thought to themselves that let's give another camp a chance, maybe they'll succeed.
The question must be whether Mr. Raisi has the capability to bring people into the equation, which I think he does. I'll say it frankly that he must believe that we can get anything done without having to be dependent on any country, and that we can make an ideal nation with a dynamic economy very easily.
Every time an administration takes office, it begins to make promises, but as problems arise later on due to the sanctions, it can't do its job as it should.
He had a set of personality traits and also his track record in the judiciary, which gave people hope that he can address some of the problems the country is facing and surmount the obstacles.
Mr. Raisi must join forces with the elite, the people who are smart and educated, people who've suffered and tasted pain to build Iran and save it from the crisis. In my opinion, he has the power to do that.
Today's is not a topic specific to any one outlet or country, so let's make a quick diversion to see what other media outlets, domestic and foreign, have to say about Iran's elections. Here's to put them in words. The Financial Tribune starts out by announcing Raisi's election as president. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on Saturday, June the 19th, expressed gratitude to the people who headed to the polls in large numbers despite economic woes, the COVID-19 pandemic, and foreign pressure. Nothing could overcome the Iranian people's determination, he said. The big winner of yesterday's election are the Iranian people. The spectacular sights of your gatherings and polling stations across the country was a clear sign of your firm resolve and hope. President Hassan Rouhani and Parliament Speaker Mohammad Baqir Ghalibaf separately visited Raisi in his office to congratulate him in person. Starting today until 45 days from now, when the country's responsibilities are transferred to the new government, I will stand by the president-elect, Rouhani said. The president promised a smooth transition of power and instructed his cabinet to fully cooperate with Raisi's team. In his televised victory speech released later in the day, Raisi stated, "I will do everything in my power to solve the country's problems, especially in regard to people's livelihood challenges." The Tehran Times quotes the Rouhani administration's foreign minister, Zarif. Zarif says all must back President-elect Raisi, predicts JCPOA would be revived in Rouhani administration. Speaking on the sidelines of Antalya Diplomacy Forum on Saturday, June the 19th, Zarif also described Raisi as a reasonable man who can govern the country. When asked about the recent arguments in the presidential debates, Zarif considered these arguments as a sign of liveliness in political atmosphere of Iran, saying, "We are way ahead of most countries in the region in terms of having a lively political debate." Zarif also predicted that the JCPOA, the official name for the 2015 nuclear deal, would most likely be revived during the remaining term of Hassan Rouhani's administration. We've got Mehr News pointing to a message from a foreign dignitary to Ebrahim Raisi. Iraq hopes of expansion of mutual relations with Iran, Saleh. Iraqi President Barham Saleh on Saturday, June the 19th, said that his country hopes for developing and expanding relations with the Islamic Republic of Iran during Raisi's tenure. He made the remarks in a telephone conversation with Iranian President-elect Sayyid Ebrahim Raisi and reiterated that his country is very interested in expanding and broadening relations with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Turning to the age-old and long-standing relations between the two countries of Iran and Iraq, he said, "We had good memories of your recent trip to Iraq, and we hope to expand and broaden our bilateral relationship." In his phone talk, Iraqi President Barham Saleh congratulated Ayatollah Raisi as president-elect of the Islamic Republic of Iran and wished him ever more success and prosperity in his new tenure. And that would be it for the news segment. Do stay with us. While Raisi is a familiar face with a well-publicized policy agenda, Civil unrest sparked by economic hardship brought on by U.S. sanctions, political corruption, and COVID-19 remains a possibility to take care of. Mostly the principalist portion of the public, as well as townships and rural areas, have shown by their vote that they are giving the president a chance to amend affairs peacefully by good administration and a firm hand. The revival of the nuclear deal or JCPOA by ongoing talks still by the outgoing administration can ease Iran's domestic economic woes to a point and reposition the country on the international scene. The JCPOA Vienna talks are on to their sixth round now.
Now that we are in a time of peace, perhaps the most important challenge we face is the economic and with respect to housing and unemployment of the youth, especially the educated ones. Unfortunately, we have a great number of educated youth who are unemployed. We have a kind of hidden unemployment too, meaning that the worker is paid a puny sum, doesn't have insurance, or the job status fitting his level of education. The sense of mistrust has dramatically increased in the markets, compounded by the hourly and daily increase of the price tag of the goods.
Here's what marks our guest would give to the legacy passed down by the Rouhani government, which, to give them credit, did sign the JCPOA, although maybe without the necessary safety valves.
I can't even grade Mr. Rouhani's administration's performance, because he failed to take advantage of opportunities that arose. He devoted all his energy to promoting ties with the West and forgot all the neighbors and economic powers in the world. The Chinese were furious. After the US withdrew from the JCPOA, we talked with China. They were upset, citing the agreement we signed and the investment they made in our oil and gas sector. They said the moment the JCPOA was reached, you threw us all out and replaced us with Shell and Total. Now go work with them if you still can. We can't score with the administration's performance. Or take the economy, for example, which saw its worst recession.
However, the world is expecting to see significant shifts by the principalist presidency at the domestic level. Although Mr. Raisi has said he wants to be leader to the whole nation, left or right, young or old, while fighting the endemic economic corruption, I asked how realistic the president-elect's presidential mottos were.
You know, he spent all his life fighting corruption. He was a judge for many, many years. And that was the main theme of his election campaign. So he would want to do some of the promises that he made. And this is going to be something that he would be interested in engaging in. You know, they come, these clerics like him, come from that liberation theology school of thought that started the Islamic Revolution. Clerics that believe they have a role in society, they need to take care of the poor, they need to have social programs.
I believe the upcoming cabinet would consist of young and at the same time expert ministers. A cabinet that's not lethargic and always behind closed doors. Or one that if people want to have an appointment with a minister, they wouldn't have to go through several stages and people like office managers or security guards. Some of the former ministers said they had to wait for up to several months for an appointment with the president to talk about something like a development project.
Now, who is Raisi, the man? The now 61-year-old, born in a northeastern village of Khorasan province, became prosecutor of Karaj, a city close to Tehran, at age 20, with clerical qualification. Only 5 years later, he was promoted to deputy prosecutor of the Revolution Court of Tehran, which he served until 1989. He continued in major judicial roles until 2015, when he found himself in the influential position of custodian of Astan Quds, that's a religious foundation close to his hometown. This helped him establish a strong base in rural areas. He set his sights on the presidency soon after and lost to Rouhani in 2017. His vote was considerable, however.
Taking a look at his resume, as far as I can remember, when he was the custodian of Astan Quds Razavi, he was really active in sport-related projects. There were a couple of lands where construction was halted during the current or the previous administration's terms. He is a director and not someone who will sit behind a desk. He removed the obstacles in the way of the construction, building a hospital and a soccer stadium, which is now one of the most modern ones in the country. These examples are the smallest scales of what he is capable of. If you generalize this to the management of the country, you can expect positive effects on the political and economic future of the country.
After losing the 2017 election, Ayatollah Khamenei appointed Ebrahim Raisi head of the judiciary in 2018. Raisi then vowed to root out corruption, and that remains a major presidential promise of his. That is tangible and palpable domestically, but the international community, rather the West, especially the US and Israel, remain to see if Raisi will differentiate between US President Biden and Trump. Americans would expect a more fiery rhetoric, even as the outgoing presidency hopes to revive the nuclear deal, and although it has become the general policy of this country to do so. The Iranian president is determined through an absolute majority of 50% plus one of the votes. With no absolute majority, the law calls for a runoff election between the top two presidential contestants to be held within 1 week of the first round of elections. Once a winner is determined, the Constitutional Council approves the election process and the leader signs off on the letter of presidency. The new president must then take an oath of office before parliament or majlis. The West may not be positive about the vote principalist Raisi made his in a contest against two other principalists and one moderate, Hemmati. But he has been congratulated for a presidential win by an array of countries, West and East, and dignitaries and movements regional. Given the city and village council elections were held at the same time as presidential elections, Tehran City Council candidates with the highest vote were also announced, Monday, June the 21st, that is. They're all principalists, which means the council is once again after 4 years in the hands of this faction, the right. Among the most important faces of those elected is Mehdi Chamran, a famous principalist and former Tehran City Council chief, who didn't win the vote last round. And also, Narges Soleimani, daughter of General Soleimani. Results show people voted for name lists rather than individual candidates. The most important responsibility city councils have, next to taking care of city and citizen affairs, is to elect the mayor and supervise his performance. That's it for today. Thanks from the whole team. But do tune in again at the same times next week and each week after, as there's bound to be surprises, as there are unfinished discussions. Till then, bye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, A maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Quraysh. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Please stay with me. Imam Baqir, peace be upon him, said, "On the day of judgment, a caller will call, 'Where are as-sabirun, the patient?' So a group of people will arise. Then a caller will call, 'Where are al-mutasabirun?' Thus a group of people will rise." Imam Baqir was asked, "Who are as-sabirun and al-mutasabirun?" Imam Baqir, peace be upon him, replied, "As-sabirun are those who are patient with performing the religious duties. Al-mutasabirun are those who are patient with the prohibitions."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salam, peace and blessings upon him, he talked about social etiquettes, he talked about behaviors which are promoted or even disapproved of in Islam. He had thousands of students, and he spoke with his students about a whole host and variety of things. And as I said, one of the things which he talked about were these akhlaq, moral, ethical issues, these rules of Islamic conduct, which, of course, if implemented on an individual, societal, and even global level, will help human beings attain perfection. So in one of these conversations, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says that there are certain people who have certain qualities and characteristics which are characteristics that are abominable, they are hateful, they are hated traits. So when Imam al-Baqir talked about these traits, he said that there are four traits which lead to the quickest punishment by Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. One of these four traits is when you mistreat a person who has treated you with kindness. Allahu Akbar. Allah is surely great, powerful, mighty, and merciful. In this conversation, Imam al-Baqir tells his companion that if you mistreat a person, if you are unkind with a person, if you are mean with a person, if you are rude with a person who has treated you kindly, who has treated you with love and respect, who has been nice to you, this treating of that kind of an individual truly leads to the quickest punishment. So, dear friends, always remember to treat people with kindness, to treat people with respect and honor, and most especially, treat people with respect and honor, those people who treat you with respect and with honor. And so if somebody treats you kindly, they treat you with respect, they treat you with honor and nobility, and you end up mistreating that kind of a person, this will lead to the quickest of punishment. This is Dialogue, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Sawdagar.
To try to relate our condition to the conditions of Imam al-Baqir, see some parallels, although it's not exactly the same. We do have some differences here. But I'm going to focus on the similarities. And then look at Imam al-Baqir, salamullahi alayhi, what he presented. There's a methodology that he presented. Imam al-Baqir, salamullahi alayhi, besides the specific words of the Prophet that he presented to the Ummah of the Prophet, besides the particular sunan, traditions of the Prophet that he tried to shed light on, the ahkam of Islam that he tried to shed light on, the tafsir of Quran that he tried to shed light on, besides the specifics, there were certain components that he stressed on repeatedly and created this, I want to call it a culture, because it became widespread. Be it that not exactly every aspect or every detail of the approach that he's presenting for people to have was taken on board by everyone, but a movement was created that led the Muslim community overall to leave the conditions they were in towards better conditions. And those principles are this. Look at the Quran itself. Refer to the Quran. We have companions coming to the Imam, ask questions about the ahkam. The Imam could simply just say, this is what the hukm is. The Imam doesn't do that. He said, have you read this verse of the Quran? Or in some instances, this could be understood from this verse of the Quran, that verse of the Quran. Telling people, go back to the Quran itself. What happened to that?
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.